So we got ahead here. We're finishing up Ezekiel, and we are starting in chapter 44 tonight. We'll be finishing up some of a kind of a thought as we looked at the temple, kind of a different way than we've looked at before. And we'll start off with a picture to kind of remind ourselves of what that looks like. And as we go through things tonight, we'll be seeing some nuggets that tie in with the New Testament. And so there'll be some fun little things along the way. So we'll jump right into chapter 44. But I want to show you again this picture of Ezekiel's temple. It's from, again, this is an artist's rendition of the dimensions that are given to us. Some of these things we'll look at tonight. Specifically, if you want to look in some of the corners, you see like the kitchen that's mentioned there. And we'll see that later on. We're going to talk specifically about that river. Why is there a river in the middle of the temple? Well, we're going to talk about that tonight. And so those things are there. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the East Gate and that kind of thing. And if we will look on the picture there, you have the main entryway of the East Gate, and then there are side entryways, kind of smaller entryways there as well. So there's a difference there on the East Gate, and we'll talk about that. So those are things we'll be talking about tonight. That gives you a mental image of these things. I'm a picture person, so when I'm reading dimensions on here, I am not an architect. I can't visualize that right away. So this helps us kind of be on the same page when we're getting to that tonight. So we're going to be jumping into chapter 44, as I mentioned, and we're going to be talking here about the message at the East Gate in these first three verses. We start off right away with something tying in with the New Testament. So again, we're still continuing with this vision that he's seeing. And right now, Ezekiel says, "Then he brought me back to the way of the outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces the east, and it was shut." And remember when last week we started about this, what happened at the East Gate? What was amazing about happening, or what did he see at the East Gate? And then after which, nobody could come in and out of the East Gate. Do you remember what happened here? Just to give you a hint, when they went into captivity, God had left the temple, right? So the East Gate, what did he see? God coming back, right? He saw the presence of God coming back through the East Gate. And so now we have here, again, he says, "The Lord said to me in verse 2, this gate shall be shut, and it shall not be opened, and no one shall enter by it, for the Lord God of Israel has entered by it, therefore it shall be shut." What I want to mention here, and what I kind of, we didn't have time to talk about last time, but any guesses as to which gate Jesus entered in through in his triumphal entry? The East Gate. Why is that significant? Huh? Because he's deity. God comes in through the East Gate, right? And so if you want to mark out here, Zechariah 9:9, talking about him coming in on a colt, the foal of a donkey. If you want to also write out here, Psalm 24, 7 through 10. Let's actually look over there at Psalm 24. "Lift up your eyes, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord of hosts, He is the King of glory." And so we have this kind of homage to gates there in Psalm 24. In Luke chapter 19, verses 37 through 38, we see that happening. Luke 19, 37 through 38. And then again in John 12, 12 through 16. If you want to write those out there, John 12, 12 through 16, we see that triumphal entry. Again, we could have mentioned this last week. We mention it here, and that the Lord, the God of Israel, came back through this gate. Christ comes in through this gate. It's kind of cool, little nugget there. If you're reading over this, you're like, oh, well, East Gate, no big deal. But when we tie it all together, we start to see some things, and we'll kind of see later on tonight of some imagery here that ties in with New Testament concepts as well. So we see that happening here. And then verse 4, beginning of verse 4, we have this message at the North Gate. He says, he brought me by way of the north gate to the front of the house, and I looked, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord, and I fell on my face. Again, seeing the glory of the Lord is important, and again, a presence kind of concept of God, and we'll talk about that more in just a moment. But he sees this, and he falls on the face before the Lord. And the Lord said to me, Son of man, mark well, see with your eyes, hear with your ears all that I say. If you want to write it here, chapter 40, verse 4, this was said earlier in the context of this vision. He says it again here. Why ears and eyes? Why are those things important that he mentions those things? Who is Ezekiel? He is, we've called him the watchman of Israel, right? I don't know if, I have received a message from somebody before when they're talking to me, and they've said, all I need you to do is listen to what I'm about to say, right? I don't need you to opine. I don't need your commentary. I just need you to listen, right? Maybe I've had a parent say that to me. My own parents said that to me before, but we see this here. See with your eyes and hear with your ears, right? Don't be touching anything. Don't be commenting. I don't need your commentary. I just need you to listen. Why? He says concerning the statutes, and then later on in this same verse, mark well the entrance of the house with all its exits. You shall say to the rebellious ones of the house of Israel. So again, thus says the Lord God is his message. Hear and see, and then say, thus says the Lord God. Is there any room for commentary in that? In that kind of, it's a pretty solid, ironclad kind of concept, right? Hear and see, tell them what I said. Has that hermeneutic principle changed for us today? Not really, no, right? Hear and see and tell them what I said. That's it. That's all you got to do. That's the same kind of thing. So as a messenger, that's what he's given. And he says to them, enough of all your abominations, O house of Israel, when you brought foreigners in, uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh. And he says this in verse 7, and then again in verse 9. And he says, you were supposed to be the ones in charge of my holy things, and you put foreigners in charge of my holy things. And so he talks to them about that. This kind of concept, uncircumcised in heart and flesh, we see again in Acts chapter 7, verse 51, with Stephen. Remember, Stephen was preaching to them a very PC message, one that nobody would get angry about, right? Actually, quite the contrary. He was very, very direct in his message. And so he calls this into account. He brings this up, uncircumcised in heart and ears, right? He says to them and brings this up. And they did not, it was not missed on them what he was saying when he said that. And so he talks about that and brings that concept up again. And the Bible uses that several times. And so what they did, he said, they made my covenant void by what they had done, setting foreigners there. And again, verse 9, he mentions this concept. But the Levites who went far from me when Israel, in verse 10, when Israel went astray, who went astray from me after their idols, shall bear the punishment of their iniquity. So again, this goes back to what we talked about earlier, about the changing of the guard. We're going to see this again. The changing of the guard from those who were to be high priests. Still Levitical priesthood, still sons of Aaron kind of concept, but it's switching from the different lineage to a different son. And so he kind of demotes them. And so he says twice that they shall bear the punishment for the iniquity. He says here in verse 10, and he says in verse 12, so they were not doing what they're supposed to do. Verse 12, what were they doing? What had they done? Or what had they become to Israel? Instead of being somebody who is leading them to God like they're supposed to, what does verse 12 say they had become? Yeah, idol worshipers. They become a stumbling block of iniquity to the house of Israel, right? And so you don't want to be a stumbling block. That's not a good thing, right? You don't want to be a stumbling block. And they had done that. And so they shall bear their iniquity. And he says in verse 14, yet I will appoint them to keep charge of the house, of all its service, and all that shall be done in it. So he demoted them essentially to temple custodians, was sort of the concept. They're still in service to God, but they are not the ones that stand before God and offering the holy things. They're no longer in connection with holy things in that way. And so now we switch to ordinances of the Levites and those who are now in charge of holy things. And he says in verse 15, "But the Levitical priests, the sons of Zadok, who kept charge of my sanctuary when the sons of Israel went astray from me, shall come near me to minister to me, and they shall stand before me to offer me the fat and the blood, declares the Lord God." To stand before the Lord, to be considered worthy to stand before God, is another big concept that ties us into the New Testament. And so in Luke, look over in Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21, verse 36. There is this, you know, kind of future day of reckoning that's mentioned. Who was able to stand? Luke 21, verse 36. "But keep on the alert at all times, praying that you may have the strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and to stand before the Son of Man." And so being able to stand before the Son of Man is very important. We see this also in Revelation chapter 6. Look over in Revelation chapter 6. When these kind of things, apocalyptic type language is being stated, in verse 17 of chapter 6, it says, "For the great day of their wrath has come, who is able to stand?" This question is asked in Revelation, who is able to stand? And then it is answered later on in chapter 7, verses 9 through 17. He says, "After these things," beginning of verse 9 of chapter 7 of Revelation, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation, all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne of the Lord, Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands, and they cry out with a loud voice, saying, 'Salvation to our God who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb.'" And so we see this great multitude who is able to stand before the throne. And so this, again, this idea of being able to stand before a holy God in service to Him is very, very important. It was not just anybody who could do that. God had selected certain people. So when He says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, "You are a holy nation, a royal priesthood. I have made everything possible, done everything possible, so you can stand before me in service to the Most High God." That's what we're talking about. And that's what he's saying here. The sons of Zadok are going to be able to stand before God and serve a holy God and offer the holy things and touch the holy things. And we'll see later on that the holy things were so holy that they couldn't, the clothes that they were serving God in, they had to change those clothes before they went out into regular kind of just the common areas, so they would not give off the holiness of God to the common people. And so even their holy foods that had been offered to them had to be prepared and behind closed doors so the holiness would not be transferred to common people. It's significant when God says, "You are a holy nation, a royal priesthood. You can stand before me and serve me." So when we see these Old Testament concepts, and we see, well, there's some people standing before God offering, you know, how drudgery, how, you know, they have to kill all these things, do all these things. It's a big deal, ladies and gentlemen. They're in the presence of God. So when we come to worship on Sunday, who is worthy to stand? We stand before God. We offer our songs of praise to a holy God. We are able to stand. Not just anybody can do that. So coming in here and singing praises to the Most High God is a big deal. It's become common, but it's a big deal. Not just anybody can do it. And I wanted to highlight that because it really, really, we're going to see here in the rest of this chapter, and these ordinances that are being made here about the Levitical priesthood, the things they're supposed to do to maintain holiness, right? The things they're supposed to do so they can be ones that serve God in that capacity. And so there are certain things, like even the way they dress, chapter beginning of verse 17 through 19, talks specifically about how they dress. Verse 18 says they're supposed to wear stuff so they will not gird themselves with anything which makes them sweat, which I think should be just a general kind of precursor to how we dress today. Just saying, like, if there's anything that makes us sweat, like a tie or coats that make us sweat when we come to worship God, just throwing it out there. Just an idea. But they were not supposed to dress anyway, not supposed to dress in wool, but supposed to dress in linen so they would not sweat in the presence of God. Just floating it out there as an idea. So they had special grooming things they're supposed to do. In verse 20, they were not to drink wine when they entered the inner court. Verse 21, hashtag Nadab and Abihu. They were not to marry a widow or divorced woman. There are certain things that were unique to them. They're supposed to live in the land, but there are certain rules and regulations that were unique to only them, and only they were supposed to keep these regulations. Does that sound familiar? Are there things, laws, that are unique to us as those who are naming themselves as Christians to serve the Most High God? There are ways that we're supposed to live, ways that we're supposed to walk, ways that we're supposed to conduct ourselves that are unique from the people that are around us. And we say, some people say, well, in immaturity would say, it's a drudgery, I don't have to do this thing, I have to serve God this way. But to those, it was a privilege to serve God because I was able to come into the presence of a holy God. And so over and over again, these things, these concepts, are being kind of reiterated, the things they're supposed to do to keep themselves separate. Here's what they say they're supposed to be doing in verse 23. Moreover, they shall teach the people the difference between the holy and profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. In a dispute, they shall take their stand as judge, and they shall judge, and according to my ordinances, they shall also keep my laws, my statutes, and all my appointed feasts, and sanctify my Sabbaths. Emphasis on ownership there, right? Whose were these? These were God's. These were not anybody else's to do anything else with, to meddle in. These were God's. And verse 23 again, the role that the priests were supposed to have, and this is what they're supposed to do, is teaching the difference between what is holy and what is profane, what is holy and what is common. And that hasn't changed. That hasn't changed. We are supposed to continue to be a holy people, for I am holy. Right, is what Peter's message is to the saints. And so we need to continue to do that. Verses 25 through 27, we have kind of ordinances here about what they're supposed to do when they've come in contact with the dead. And these are things that are not different than what we see in the book of Numbers and we see in the law. These are very similar things we're supposed to be doing. Look in verse 28. This is interesting. And it shall be, and with regard to inheritance for them, that I am their inheritance, and you shall give them no possession in Israel. I am their possession. Does that sound awesome? Is that a pretty good, that's a pretty stable foundation as an inheritance? I am. The I am says, I am their inheritance. If you want to write out here in Numbers chapter 18, verse 20, we see that there in the very beginning, in the concept of Levitical priesthood, Numbers 18, verse 20. I am their possession. And so because I am their possession, verse 29, they shall eat the grain offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering, and every devoted thing in Israel shall be theirs. So when God says, when you give it to me, you've given it to the Levites, right? So that's what's happening. The first fruits of all the fruits of every kind, of every contribution of every kind, from all your contributions, shall be for the priests. You shall also give the priests the first of your dough or coarse meal to cause a blessing to rest on your house. The priest shall not eat any bird or beast that has died of natural death or has been torn to pieces, aka roadkill, right? So they can't eat anything, those kind of things. But we see here God's provision for his holy people. God's provision for his holy people. That has not changed. Consider the lilies of the field, right? That has not changed. I am their possession. That hasn't changed. We're going to skip a little bit here in chapter 45. We have a holy land for the Levites. We're going to see this later on mentioned, and we're going to talk in greater detail later on And so we're going to kind of skip it here. But if you want to write it out here, this is also mentioned in chapter 48, verses 8 through 20, and is mentioned in more detail, so we'll cover it there and kind of move along hurriedly here in our study. And so we have a portion for the prince, or land for the princes. And, you know, who are these fair princes that they speak of? So this is talking about future rulers, those who would be, there's no longer really a king. There would never be really a king. Well, like we said before, the Hasmonean dynasty would come on later on. They're just these usurpers. They were never unanimously accepted as rulers. Can make a joke there, but I'm not going to do it. So they were never unanimously accepted as rulers. They were just kind of upstarts. And so there were these princes that were rulers. And so he says the property on either side of this land would be for the princes. And verse 8 says why. It says, this shall be for his land, for a possession of Israel. So my princes shall no longer oppress my people. Do we read stories, or have we read stories in the Old Testament of people taking land from people because they wanted it? Yeah, we do, right? There were leaders who were taking land from others and those kind of things. And he said, that should no longer be. That should not happen. In verse 9, we see this concept of justice that is just balances. Thus says the Lord God, enough, you princes of Israel, put away violence and destruction and practice justice and righteousness. Stop your expropriations from my people, declares God. And then he goes into talking about just balances. We have actually, those a political office of those who keep and make sure all balances and measurements and everything stay on, there's a standard way of measuring things. And he said there should be a just balance. An ephah, an adjust bath. It's not a bubble bath. It's a unit of measurement. And so he talks about these kind of things and how they should be metered out. We're not going to get bogged down into those things because I'd tell you the details and you'd forget, and you could look them up if you want to. And so he talks about those here. And then he talks about offerings that are to be provided. verses 13 through 16 are these offerings that are supposed to be given to the prince. And we see they're measured out here and what they're supposed to do. But 16 to 17 is interesting. He says, all the people of the land shall give to this offering for the prince in Israel. It shall be the prince's part to provide the burnt offerings and the grain offerings and the drink offerings at the feasts and the new moons and the Sabbaths. Did y'all pick up on that? All the people give all these things that are listed here to the prince. Then the prince turns around and supplies these things for the Sabbaths and the new moons and the different offerings that are supposed to be taking place. And we're going to talk about some of those tonight. So this is taxation with extreme representation, right? And so this is exactly what this is, that as far as providing, that they will provide these things. And so it goes into talking about what is supposed to be provided at what time and with no blemish. And those things, and so talking about the seventh day of the month, there's one in verse 20, it says, thus I shall do on the seventh day of the month, for everyone who goes astray or is naive, you shall make an atonement for the house. And so even an atonement for those who may not have known. Verse 21, we have the first month of the 14th day of the month, you shall have the Passover, a feast of 7 days. Unleavened bread shall be eaten. And so we see these things being mentioned again, like we saw them mentioned before. Now again, where are they right now? Where are the people who are receiving this message? Where are they? In captivity, right? And they had really just started. I mean, the city has fallen, and the final siege, the temple's been destroyed. Why are they getting a history lesson or a reminder of these things? Well, we're going to try and tie that up later on. But again, as we said before, this is God saying, you're going to go back. And you're going to go back and you're going to do these things, right? And you're going to do these things again. I'll be with you. So there's this future hope that's set out there in front of them. They've got to endure this time now, but there's this future time when we'll be together. And so he's talking about these things right now. So let's go along 46. We see the prince's offering. Thus says the Lord God, verse 1. The gate of the inner court facing east shall be shut, and the six working days, but it shall be open on the Sabbath day and open on the day of the new moon. The prince shall enter by way of the porch of the gate from the outside and stand by the post of the gate. And then the priest shall provide his burnt offering and the peace offering. So there are these offerings that are made at the east gate. And he starts talking about worship that's done at the east gate. In verse 3, the people of the land also shall also worship at the doorway of the gate before the Lord on the Sabbaths and on the new moons. And the burnt offering which the prince shall offer on the Lord on the Sabbath day shall be six lambs. And he talks about those things. And he talks about in verse 6, on the day of the new moon he shall offer a young bull without blemish. And talks about the things that are going on there. Verse 9, but when the people of the land come up before the Lord at the appointed feasts, he who enters by way of the north gate to worship shall go out by way of the south gate. And the opposite is mentioned as well. No one shall return by way of the gate by which he entered, but shall go straight out. So this is this interesting kind of concept that's mentioned. You go in, you go through, you worship, and you leave, right? So that'd be equivalent of coming in through here and exiting out these doors, right? Or exiting out some other way, which would be terribly inconvenient. But we see this as kind of a mandate here. Now, we're going to get into something later on that kind of might kind of see why that's being mentioned here, but it's something that we haven't seen before. The prince is going to come in among them like he's one of them as well, in verse 10. At the festivals and the appointed feasts, the grain offering shall be an ephah. He talks about those things that are mentioned. The free will, when the prince provides a free will offering, and so he also offers that at the feast at the east gate. And so a lot happening at the east gate, and so a lot going on with these things. Now I want to mention here in verse 19, we have 19 and 20, the boiling places, the places to boil. Then he brought me through the entrance that was the side of the gate to the holy chambers for the priests, which faced north. And behold, there was a place at the extreme near of the west. And he said to me, this is a place where priests shall boil in the guilt offering and the sin offering, and they shall bake the grain offering, in order they may not bring them out in the outer court to transmit holiness to the people. And so again, this is that concept that we talked about earlier. They're supposed to change their clothes, that they were, whatever they had worn in the presence of the holiness of God, they were to change those clothes before they went out to be with into this, the common area, so they would not transmit God's holiness onto the people. And the same thing with their food. So these things that they had been brought to them, they were to boil, prepare, bake before they went out. And so it kind of removed the holiness from them. They're now common. They're now ready to eat. And so they take them out. Yes? What's that? This vision? Well, I mean, daily there were sacrifices they were supposed to do. Once temple worship was reinstated, is that what you're talking about? So the question is, how long were they doing this? So once temple worship was reinstated and they came back and that kind of thing was happening again, which we'll see in just a moment, that went on until obviously the destruction of the temple. They were supposed to be doing it. But every day there was activity in the temple. They were supposed to be doing these kind of burnt offerings and offering the lamb in the morning and the evening. All these things supposed to be doing all the time to maintain kind of that holiness they're supposed to be doing. And again, all these things that they do, they offer before God. And when we think of a burnt offering, right? I remember as a kid, and I always mention the flannel graph. When I was a kid, teachers taught with the flannel graph a lot, right? So a lot of these Bible images I have flannel graph images for. Or Bible stories. So when they had these burnt offerings, in my mind, I imagine they just, you know, they killed the sheep and then they put this whole thing on the altar and they burned the whole thing up until it was crispified, right? And then, you know, that was not the case. They would offer a part of it and then just take the rest of the animal over. And so there were specific things they're supposed to offer. Then the animal would go and be boiled or prepared to be stored or whatever it is for the Levites. And so they're continually getting food, right, being brought to them. Is that kind of what you're talking about, or am I getting close? Okay. If not, we can talk afterwards. I'm sorry. But yeah, so that was a continual thing, and they did when temple worship was instated. And so, so they had these boiling places to prepare the food, and we see that here. Then he brought me out to outer court, and so he talks about these four corners. Verse 23, there was a row of masonry around them, and the corner of them, and the boiling places were made. So he talks about other ones. These were the boiling places where the ministers of the house shall boil the sacrifices of the people. So again, just a place to prepare the food that has been brought to them, to store that food. Chapter 47, water from the temple. All right. So you saw in the image, there's this like river running out. And he talks about here that this came out from the right side of the house, so the house of the Lord, water flowing down from under, from the right side of the house, verse 1. And he talks about a man who went out toward the east with a line in his hand, something to measure, and he measured 1,000 cubits, and he led me through the water, and the water reaching my ankles. And he talks about the water getting deeper every 1,000 cubits they go out, to the point where he couldn't walk across it. It was too deep to ford, and he talks about this water. And verse 8, he said, then he said to me, these waters go out toward the eastern region and go down into the Arabah. And then they go down towards the sea and being made to flow into the sea, and the waters of the sea become fresh. And it'll come about that every living creature which swarms in every place where the river goes will live, and there will be very many fish, for those watchers of the waters go there and the others become fresh. So everything will live where the river goes. And he begins talking about the fishermen, which I love hearing about this. You know, they'll be able to spread their nets and catch all these fish. The swamps and marshes will not become fresh. But why is this water that's refreshing everything? Why is that something you want to hear about? Water that refreshes and makes everything new again. Well, there's baptism. We think, you know, right? Water, baptism, right? We're programmed to think that way, but when we think about living waters, when we think about this refreshing, remember they've come from a land that has been from plague and pestilence and sword and beast and just destroyed and all that kind of stuff. And now they're going back to a land with water that's fresh and everything's living and nice. Look in verse 12. By the river on its bank, by one of the side of the other, will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither. Their fruit will not fail. They will bear every month because their water flows from the sanctuary, and their fruit will be for food and their leaves for healing. This is what they want. If I want to go back to a land, do I want to go back to a land that's destroyed and nothing there and nothing lives? Or do I want to go back to a land that God's promised me that, hey, it's going to be healed again? That's the land I want to go back to. Look over in Revelation chapter 22. Josh, why do you keep going to Revelation all the time? Well, there's a lot of imagery that ties in between this. Again, this is a vision. These things aren't literally going to happen, okay? We never see that kind of temple being built, right? It's a very humble temple that ends up getting built. There's never a river that flows out from that temple. This is an imagery. Now, the service that is supposed to be done, the ordinances that were mentioned for the Levites, those are the same. Those haven't changed from when they were first given. But this is something that we see in a vision, as hope. And so in Revelation 21, it says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, a new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven, from God, made ready as a bride for the husband. So we see this new, I'm sorry, 22, not 21, 22, verse 1. That's important. Then he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street, on either side of the river, was a tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Does that sound familiar? And so, again, we go back to this concept that we're promised to go back as a people that are in captivity. Israel's in captivity. They're promised to go back to the promised land that God has provided them. And we as a people of God who are wandering and pilgrims in this foreign land are promised to go back. And we see this imagery here. And it's not tonight. We'll see another image that's being brought out here. And so there's this living water and these things that are here, and this healing concept should be kind of emphasized here with this. Again, not a literal thing that's going to be happening, but the healing of the land. And then we get into the boundaries of the land, and again, this kind of division that's going to be dividing the land out. In verse 21, he says, "So you shall divide this land among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel." And he talks about the land specifically and the land of its boundaries. And we'll see, I'll show a picture here. Do I do it now? I don't do it now. When do I do it? Okay. in a moment, I'll have a picture of this, of what this looks like. But we see the division in chapter 48, the vision of the land. Is that the first bell? Okay, so chapter 48, we see the division according to the tribes. And in verse 8, we see this a part that's set apart. "And beside the border of Judah, from the east side or the west side, you shall be the atonement or allotment, which you shall set apart, 25,000 cubits, which is 7.1 miles and in the width and length, like one of the portions from the east side or the west side. The sanctuary shall be in the middle of it." So he begins talking about this sanctuary and the portion for the priests. And chapter 21 of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 9 through 27, talks about this new Jerusalem, and again, a new city. So we see this imagery again from Revelation that's here. There's not going to be a literal city like this that they go back to, all right? This is just this kind of concept that things are going to be made new, and you're going to go back to this. Look in verse 20. It says, "The whole atonement or allotment shall be 25,000 by 25,000 cubits, 7.1 miles by 7.1 miles. In Revelation chapter 20, verse 16, it is 1,500 by 1,500 by 1,500 miles is the imagery that's given to us. Or it says furlongs, but I can't remember how many furlongs it was. You can do the math backwards if you want to figure out the furlongs, or just look it up in Revelation 21:16. I forget the furlongs, but it translates into 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles cubed of this holy city. And so measurements of a holy city are given for those who are in captivity. Measurements of a holy city are given to us of a promised land that we will be going back to. Why is that important? Why is that significant? Again, God is saying you're going to go to a better place. Hold on. Endure the captivity, but you're going to go back to a place that I promised. And so we see that kind of going back and forth. And then we continue with the division of the tribes and the proportion for the prince as well. And then we go in verse 30. We start with the city gates and talks about those as well and their measurements. Verse 35, the end here, he says, "The city shall be 18,000 cubits round about, and the name of the city shall be The Lord is Here." Again, God left, right? The Lord left. They went into captivity. They had forsaken God. He left, allowed them to go into captivity, and now they're going to come back. God has shown in this vision this magnificent entrance through the east gate and God's presence that's going to be there with him. And the name of the city shall be The Lord is Here. That's what they need to hear. That's what they need to know while they're in the captivity. That message hasn't changed. We see that in Revelation as well. That God says, hang on, you're going to go through this time, don't get bogged down in the numbers, right? You're going to go through this time, but I'm here, I will never leave you or forsake you, and we will be together forever. Is that encouraging? As saints who serve the Most High God, they get to stand before His holiness and serve Him, I'll be there with you. That's the message of the book of Ezekiel as we end this book. It started off really rough, right? He called them out on all the things that they were doing, but it ends with this message: we'll be good again. I'll be with you. Any thoughts or questions as we close this book? Thank you very much for your patience. This is the longest time I've ever taken to go through any book of the Bible, but I appreciate your patience with us. Thank you.